You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Former Australian magistrate David Halpern has recently told ABC's Four Corners that governments are underestimating the reach and threat of the sovereign citizenship movement following the killings of two police officers. The alleged killer, Desi Freeman, has expressed strong support for sovereign citizenship online. I spoke to Stephen Young, an associate law professor at the University of Otago, on sovereign citizenship, what this movement looks like here in Aotearoa, and whether it should be seen as a concern. To start, what is a sovereign citizen?
That's a great question. The term sovereign citizen is an umbrella term that we use to refer to a bunch of different people. But essentially, these are people who believe that the government and state institutions like courts, the judiciary, local government are corrupt. And for that reason, they're trying to reassert a lawful order, or they think that they have a true lawful order, which derives from either foundational legal instruments like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, or here in New Zealand, that would be like Te Whakaputanga, which is the Declaration of Independence, or Te Tiriti o Waitangi. So there might be foundational documents, or it could derive from natural law or God's law, or sometimes they refer to it as common law. But essentially, they believe the state is corrupt.
When did this movement start up? Is it a relatively new concept?
No, it's not a new concept. It's kind of hard to describe because this is a movement with a lot of interlocking parts. And the words that we use to describe it is not the words that they use to describe themselves. So in the United States, there were several different groups that sort of arose in the 70s and 80s, and they were very interested in sort of government corruption or state corruption. They saw it as corrupt. They involved a lot of conspiracy movements and conspiracy theories. But in the 1990s is when the label sovereign citizen was really imposed upon them. They identified, at least some of them identified as sovereign citizens, and this is in the United States in the 1990s. And sometimes, I'd say, this movement has really overgrown the United States. So it's now in Canada, it's in Europe, it's here, and it's pretty rare that people self-identify as sovereign citizens. Instead, what they usually do is sort of have the beliefs or espouse the beliefs of sovereign citizens back from the 1990s or earlier.
You mentioned earlier He Whakaputanga and Te Tiriti o Waitangi. What does the sovereign citizenship movement look like specifically here in Aotearoa? Are there many differences compared to other countries such as Australia and what you mentioned in the US?
It's difficult to say. There are some unique things here as how it's expressed here, but I should say it's unique where it's expressed everywhere. And that's because whenever it moves around, it sort of responds to local legal discourse. So here, they would say, at least some of them might say that the state is corrupt because of certain foundational documents. Te Whakaputanga and Te Tiriti o Waitangi are some of them. And that changes how it's sort of expressed. And also, it's expressed differently here because of local councils. In the United States, there's not local councils like there are here. So it has a different flavor, I guess you could sort of say. But the core of the movement, the core of the ideology really remains quite similar.
You've briefly touched on this, but if we are looking at individuals who align with this movement or the ideas of this movement, do they all have similar views, or are their beliefs of this movement quite broad overall?
Another really great question, and it's hard to describe with accuracy. And that's because the way we identify people who are involved in this movement has to do with they sort of repeat certain things that we can identify. So we sort of see them and say, they're quite similar in this regard. And I think that there's some research that suggests that these beliefs are quite static, that they don't change that much over time. But if we sort of do a wide sweep of this movement and look at it in the United States and look at it here and look at it in Canada, we do see that there's quite a bit of variation. So it's really hard to sort of pin down precise beliefs or what they believe in, because some of them will say, that's sovereign citizen stuff, that's nonsense. And then they'll go on and sort of talk about other things that sort of align with sovereign citizen stuff. So they might have conspiracy theories or spiritual beliefs about certain things that align with the things that sovereign citizens would say.
How do the courts view this movement? Do sovereign citizens have much power in the legal space?
They have almost no power in the legal space. The theories and the views of law that they hold have been widely rejected in courts. I don't think that they have ever won on the merits, and that's really unsurprising because their views of law do not really conform to the way that lawyers and people that are trained to understand law understand it. So they have a dual narrative or a different narrative of what the law means. So, and I'm speaking sort of from the United States. In the United States, you know, we sort of say that the Constitution is, you know, creates one nation, and they say, well, that's wrong. There's actually two nations. There is one nation that was formed initially, but through the Civil War, that means there's been now two nations, and there's a federal government that's now corrupt and is trying to draw people into franchises and into business opportunities and things like that. And that's very contrary to the way we understand law. But they understand law this way, so they have very little success in courts.
Speaking more to the US, the FBI has classified the movement as a domestic terrorism threat. If we haven't already, should we label these individuals in a similar way?
It's really hard to say. I think that there is an aspect of this movement that has been violent, at least historically. But if we look back at the United States, there were several different groups that were active in the 90s, and one of these was the militia movement. And the militia movement, as the name might sort of indicate, is very interested in guns and defend themselves to the Second Amendment right. They were also included in this umbrella term of sovereign citizens. And I'm not sure that there's any similar movement like that here. Unfortunately, we do see that there are moments where people lash out with violence, especially we've seen that lately in Australia. I don't think that they're going to lash out at the public. What we tend to see is more sort of violence occurring when they're stopped by police or when police come onto their property and try to serve a warrant or something like that. That can be violent, but that doesn't necessarily indicate that these people are terrorists. And of course, that's different from the United States than it is here or from Australia. So that's my way of saying I think it might make sense more in the United States than it does here. I'd be very cautious about labeling an entire group, especially with an umbrella term, domestic terrorists.
The movement grew quite a lot following COVID-19. Could we see this movement grow even more, or would you say it's on a sort of downturn?
I think what we have seen, looking at the history of this movement, is whenever there are significant reasons in society for people to be stressed out, whether it's the global financial crisis of 2008 to 2011, or COVID, or if we go back in time, sort of the tech.com bubble, or before that, the farm crisis in the United States in 1984, or earlier than that, the movement really grows in times of socioeconomic troubles. We know that. And we were hoping that after COVID, things would sort of return to normal and we'd see a decrease in this activity, but I'm not sure that we have. And I think that has to do with socioeconomic feelings. So even though COVID was incredibly stressful for many people, I don't think people are feeling, I think that there's a large section of society that's still feeling socioeconomic stress, which is contributing to feeling this movement.
So what should we expect regarding this movement, specifically here in Aotearoa, heading forward?
You're asking me to predict the future, and that's really hard to do. I'm not sure what to expect going forward. I would expect more of the same. So we're going to see a lot of people in courts clogging them up. We're going to see lots of people engaging with local councils, engaging in things that local councils would say, you know, just pay your rates, pay your fines or whatever. We don't need to tie up processes like this. I'm not sure that we're going to see violence. I really hope that we don't. But there is, of course, a low potential that that happens.
And I guess, finally, is there a way to combat people who sort of fall down this pipeline?
So, unfortunately, there's no type of deprogramming regime that I know of or that I've heard of or read about that works. Instead, I think what we can do as a society is sort of remove the reasons why people would be attracted to conspiracy theories and anti-institutional movements. So if we work on creating a society that's more accessible and more open and people feel like they're being treated well, then I don't think they're going to be very interested in conspiracy theories.
That was the University of Otago's Stephen Young on the sovereign citizenship movement following the alleged killer of two Australian police officers, Desi Freeman, expressing strong support for the movement online and whether this movement should be seen as a concern here in Aotearoa.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/becasts.